You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Running with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're so delighted that you're with us again, whether you're watching or listening live, or you're joining us later on a podcast. Thank you so much for sharing some of your precious time with us. That was the Hot Texas Swing Band starting us off with a little bit of their original song, Hot Texas. And Jim, who's our guest with us tonight?
Guest tonight is returning author Martha Burns.
We're her so first delighted book to was, have her.
We profiled last year was Blind Eye. And tonight's book is Across the Narrows.
Two books, yes, from our guest. Hello, Martha. Welcome.
Nice to be with you all again tonight.
Yes, and she's kind of a neighbor. Where is home?
In Santa Fe and just up the road from you all.
Yes, yes.
It is.
Yes. We keep saying we need to get together. So I think that will happen.
I hope
that will happen on a Sunday in March. I feel it in my bones. Jim, do you want to tell us a little something about
We have a little bio here. Martha Burns, a native of New Mexico, earned a Doctor of Letters with distinction from Drew University and won the Faulkner Wisdom Gold Medal for short story. Martha is a mother of two daughters and now has four grandchildren. She has lived and worked in La Luz, New Mexico, New Jersey, Hawaii, California, and Switzerland, and now lives in Santa Fe with her husband and two Jack Russell Terriers. Her first novel, Blind Eye, was a finalist for the Spur Award for Contemporary Fiction. Welcome, Martha.
Welcome. So since you were with us and we were discussing Blind Eye the last time you were here, what all has been going on, Martha?
I pulled out of a bottom drawer my manuscript for Across the Narrows. And really, when I was still finalizing the publication of Blind Eye, I was working on Across the Narrows. And I'm not a prolific writer by any means, and I'm slow. And so it took me, a couple of years to get it back in shape to publish it.
Mm-hmm. What else is in that bottom drawer? What's underneath?
There's a slush pile in there. So.
Well, why don't you just catch us up a little bit? We have so much to talk about tonight, but for people that weren't with us a year ago, Tell us a little bit just about yourself and maybe how you started writing.
Okay. Well, and you had asked me this when we visited a couple of nights ago, and it's harder for me to remember when I didn't write, but I came to writing later. And I really think that I first came to read. I mean, I was always a big reader. I think you all are too. And I think, like a lot of writers, I just wanted to see how they did it. Uh-huh. I can remember, but I did take years ago a correspondence course in writing. And I was living in Switzerland at the time and had two young little girls. And so I did correspondence, and I didn't know what I was doing. I did a starter novel. So that was back in the 90s, and that's when I started writing. But I think it was this urge or urgency to figure out, a beloved book. Well, how did they do that?
Mm-hmm.
And then later, I came to have in my head stories I wanted to tell, but that was later.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, of course, as we always say, we are readers and we are not writers. And so we come to it kind of as readers. But the writing process is so fascinating to us. As an author, when you read, does it take some of, how do I say this, the joy out of reading? Because as an author, you're trying to figure out, or you say to yourself, well, why did she write it that way? Or
yeah, I think it has definitely changed me. And so that's why sometimes I enjoy a book that is, it's just got that, that's something that just forces you, that it just leads you to just keep turning the pages as opposed to trying to figure it out. But I'm always, and then I sometimes writing is so gorgeous to me, people's writing, that I'm busy taking down, you know, a quote or something like that. And I used to write in my books all the time, which would, you know, it's just a drive. And then now, there's this urgency to have a pen in my hand when I'm reading. So if I'm reading something, I put that pen away. So,
do you ever go back and read things that you've written? I mean, do you go back and read Blind Eye, or do you go back and some of the other things? And then how do you think about them?
It's you know, humbling, actually. And I have just recently, in preparation for this interview and then my book launch, I just went back and read Across the Narrows from beginning to end, because really a year and a half and working towards publishing it and so forth, that's not reading it. And that's really kind of a love-hate relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard.
Go ahead.
You're reading it and you're thinking, not so much that I feel like it's a mistake or something, I'll think, oh, well, I should bring that up later. It's just, you know. It's fun though too.
The on the cover, and we're going to talk about the cover in greater detail in a minute, but or a little later. But on the cover, there is a quote from Kirkus Reviews: "Burns, a skillful wordsmith, has delivered an addictive read," and it's, you know, kind of right along here. And as readers, we don't even go to the guest's website first. We don't go find it anywhere to read reviews. We just want to, you know, come to it. But you can't avoid, you know, reading.
Right, right.
And I thought, wow, Kirkus Reviews, an addictive read. I thought, wow. And you know what it is? It is an addictive read. I found, as I shared a little bit the other night, when I opened it and I began reading, I felt like this is literary fiction. I have just stepped into the middle of what should be a masterpiece, PBS masterpiece series, and I'm kind of missing the first few seasons of it. I'm starting right, you know, on this particular day in this particular year, but we know, and you help us as the author understand what went on before. And I was addicted. I, your writing, Jim and I were talking last night, and I said, your writing is like savoring a delicious morsel. If you're a vegetarian, you'll have to substitute your favorite thing that you like to chew, but it's like meat. It feeds the soul. It makes our minds work at something. Your descriptions are so, to me, poetic and like a painting, where I'm having to work a little as a reader. And I'm not unhappy with with that. But I thought, you know what, this is addictive, and I want to know what happens with these characters and what else is she going to reveal about them.
Those are all kind words. I mean, all I ever wanted was a reader. And when I wrote Blind Eye and then this novel, actually I started working on this novel before Blind Eye, then put anyway, both of them. But I have to have something I really care about. Mm-hmm. Otherwise I can't, I'm just stuck. So I really cared about this. But thank you for those words.
You said this is about a 2-year project, as I remember.
No, even longer, Jim.
More than that, okay.
One of the several of the chapters in here come from short stories I wrote when I was in graduate school, and then sat around and I didn't know. Yeah. A long time I've tried to tell this story.
Okay.
Well, okay. Again, Kirkus kind of puts it in historical fiction, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree. I felt like there was a lot more to the story and the characters and your writing than what I would say sometimes we find in historical fiction. Where would you place it?
Well, you know, I was flattered when Kirkus put it in historical fiction, because I wanted to make sure I got the history right.
And there is history.
And then the different things I bring up about, there's a chapter that takes place when Charles Lindbergh is at a banquet in New York City. And things like that, I wanted to make sure I got them right. But I think, you know, reviewers or Amazon, or they just put your book kind of willy-nilly into a category, not characters. I think it's more, I aspire to writing literary fiction, but I think it's more fiction with a historical backdrop as opposed to historical fiction, because I would hate to sit at a table with historical fiction writers.
You do get, you know, they does cover a lot of years. You want to just take a moment and just give us a broad, background to the story.
Well, the novel has two points of view. It has two female points of view. It begins in 1924, way back in 1924 in Brooklyn, New York, with a woman named Ruby. And it begins in a hospital when she has just given birth to a baby who is a blue baby. And then later she has another child, Alice, and the next year, and that's her sixth child. And then, so the novel follows Ruby's life and Alice's life, and it, about midway through the novel, the point of view, which I'm known to do in my novels, switches to Alice's point of view. And the story goes up until the last chapter is in 1989. So it's a 65-year spread of time. And just like we were talking about the history and so forth, it all, place is really important to me. So it's almost like a character. So the novel begins and ends in Brooklyn, New York, which, you know, you talk to anybody, you know, just someone you meet in a coffee shop, and they, almost everybody has a connection to Brooklyn.
To Brooklyn.
You know, but it begins and ends in Brooklyn. But the second half of the novel with the Alice character takes place in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the novel is also not based, but it's inspired by my mother's life. So it's close, you know, it's close to
Which of the two women is your mom?
Alice, the younger, yeah.
Alice.
And so that Ruby would be my grandmother.
Yeah, yeah. There's a wonderful cast of characters. I mean, we have the two main ones, but there's a huge cast of characters. And they're all engaging, and some of them just make a fleeting, you know, some of the maids and things are there and then they're not, but some of them are just so very engaging. How, we're going to take a break in just a moment. So I'll just ask this question. Was it challenging to capture Ruby's voice, which is in the first person point of view, and Alice's, which is kind of the third person?
Right.
To how was that challenging? How to differentiate their voices?
It was, because also, you know, Ruby's voice is a woman who was, she was just 30 when the novel opens, and so it's 1924. So that voice had, especially since it was first person, had to be quite different from Alice, who was, well, she was born in 1925. In the novel. So, but yet, you know, she comes of age in the, you know, in the 40s and so forth. So I had to, and I didn't always hopefully now it's kind of true to their characters. But as I was working on the novel, and my readers, my early readers, sometimes they would say, I can't distinguish these voices. It was, you know, that was a challenge. You're right.
Mm-hmm. I would think so. Do you have a question before we take a break?
Well, a little bit of a process question, but I assume that you did a lot of research on this. Even though these were family members, you had to do a lot of work to kind of put this together, and, at least with the storyline.
And I love doing that research. Yeah. And, then I have to tell myself to get busy and, okay, no, put it away. But I did do a lot of research, and I wanted, especially with the social, we were talking about this the other night, the social construct of the period, I really wanted to make sure that I had that right.
And when we come back, we're going to talk more about the social constructs and all of the characters from this wonderful read, Across the Narrows. And we're going to show you where one of the places that you can find this book through our Out West Shop affiliate page on bookshop.org. Stay tuned. Don't go away. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com. Find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guest Martha Burns. We're talking about her book, The Narrows, Across the Narrows. I usually want to say Verrazano.
I know,
Bridge, so I got to get that out of my mind. this is a book, to me, it's kind of a book about tragedy and triumph. It's about women, told by women, strong women. And to me, it's a little bit, we kind of put the men on the sideline once in a while and, let the women tell the story. And I kind of get the feeling that, here's some things the men don't understand. Mm-hmm. They're all involved in their world, and they kind of don't think about all the dilemmas and things that occur to the ladies. Talk to us about Ruby. What kind of lady is she?
Yeah, give us more Ruby.
Well, I think that by design, too, the novel is somewhat ambiguous about Ruby. I can clearly say to you what I think Alice's, life story is, or her motivation, or her intentions. Ruby's, even having written the book and feeling like I have revealed a character, I'm not so sure. Mm-hmm. I think she was such a product of her time. I created this magnificent character of this Ruby, who was the youngest of six children, growing up in a brownstone on President Street in Brooklyn, in a happy childhood with a father who was a well-known pastor in Brooklyn at the time when Brooklyn was known as, for several things, it was called the city of rubber tree plants. I don't know why you would call a city that, but it was also called the city of churches. And you talk about architecture, beautiful architecture, and her father, Ruby's father, was the pastor at this very large Dutch Reformed church in Brooklyn, which I visited. And so she had this magnificent childhood, and then actually went to, I'm talking about my character, actually went to Bryn Mawr. She went to King's College in Nova Scotia first, and then her parents thought she was a little too far afield. And so she's an educated woman, and she wants to be a writer. And then she marries, and she has child after child after child. Mm-hmm. And there was really very little opportunity for her to express herself, to be a person in her own right.
Mm-hmm. Her parents in the section, in many of the sections where we're hearing Ruby's voice, and she'll talk about her mom, Ella, right. And her dad, of course, the minister that you're talking about. And Ella's an interesting, you know, because this is sort of a story that has, we have more than one mother. You know, we have Ella, we have the mother-in-law, Ruby's mother-in-law. Later on, Alice, the daughter, becomes, of course, a mother. And so we have some different mothers in this story. And Ella's into reading detective fiction and Agatha Christie, which of course would be very timely. And she also has some, you know, all of our moms, we grow up with little statements that our moms or our parents, you know, kind of make. And we hear some of Ella's little statements. And I think Ruby does it too, but like tisket tasket or for want of a nail or, you know, right. things that were probably even more timely then than those might be now. And I think it brings so much color to the characters and again, sort of to that time period.
Right.
And it feels like Ruby's mom has kind of said, my kids are growing. And, you know, I'm retirement for, you know, I'm into the part of my life now where I'm going to just do what I like to do. And I'm just going to sit and read and be content.
Right. Right. Manage your home. And right. Right. I say in the novel that Ruby's religion was contentment. And she just lived a very, her mother, Ruby's mother.
Yeah. And don't we all want, I kind of want that.
Right.
I kind of want to just sit and read, not have to do anything else. I kind of want Ella's life.
Yes. I think she had a nice life.
How about Alice? What's your take on Alice?
Alice, I think, was because of the tragedy she experienced, and that was being separated from her mother, you know, from childhood on. I think that she lived a life of investigating. She was always had this question about her mother, about why her mother had left her. And since it was inspired by my mother Alice, I have not changed her name. Is that I've always told people that in order to understand my mother, I've lost my mother now, but in order to know my mother, you had to have known what she lost. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the character I tried to portray here. Although I don't think Alice wore it on her sleeves, but it was, you know, mm-hmm. her whole life. And hopefully I've carried that through in the novel, mm-hmm. but it was always part of her. She was always investigating, mm-hmm. and searching.
Yeah. We talked about social constructs a little bit ago, and there is one that is really what causes, and you've just mentioned, you know, there's abandonment, there's rift. What happens, I don't think it's a spoiler alert, it's pivotal to the storyline, and it's so interesting. What happens that causes Ruby and her kids to no longer, you know, be a unit?
Well, what happened is that Ruby, by the time this takes place in the novel, early 1930s, and she decides that she wants a separate life. That is a loveless marriage, probably. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that was open to her, available to her, was to file for a legal separation. She could not. You know, in New York State, or probably many states at the time, she could not obtain a divorce. There was no choice. So she does, and her husband countersues her. And what was available to him and easy to countersue, he could sue her for divorce, was to charge her with two things: abandonment and adultery.
Mm-hmm. which she was totally innocent of.
Right.
You just want to go, what?
And you know, and I wasn't really writing the, but that was, it wasn't uncommon.
Right.
You know, we think it was uncommon for people to divorce. So she was divorced, but because he divorced her.
Right.
And then the courts gave him custody of the six children. Mm-hmm. And then Alice at the time was four. Mm-hmm. And then he abandoned her.
Mm-hmm.
So
I really like both women. I like Ruby very much, and I see just what a challenge to pick up and move forward. And there's part of the agreement is, you know, he can take him away for up to a year and then he has to come back. And then that year passes and she has no idea where they are. And she wouldn't, you know, this is in a time period where we don't have internet searches. We don't have history.com. You know, we don't have any of the DNA sites. We don't have all these wonderful resources that we have today to try to find our relative stories.
Nobody comes knocking on the door.
No. Yeah. And so she really just has to pick, you know, she just has to kind of keep going. And then Alice, one of the things that I thought was so, I really enjoyed about Alice was that she would often say to herself, what would my mother do? Mm-hmm. And she has some memories, even though she was four. She has more memories, I think, of those early years than I wish I had with my mom at that time. Yeah. But she does wonder, of course, you know, how did this happen and how is it that we're not together? But she's always, I think, also kind of wondering, what of me is my mother?
Right.
And my mother's family, my mother, you know, she's still with her dad. She's, you know, there, the dad has a life with these kids, but doesn't fill them in on anything. And so she really is adrift, but she's quite clever and she finds some resources.
Right. Right.
What is one or two things that she does?
You know, and then you were pointing out the Kierkegaard's little quote. The other quote that they said is that these were strong female characters. And I'm so pleased with that. Alice decides on a trip to New York, which gave me the opportunity to take the novel back again into New York. She decides that she's going to go to the New York Public Library. And she remembers, she goes to the New York Public Library and she does know her mother's maiden name. And so she does some research at the library and she meets one, you know, I love reference librarians.
Yes, you do too.
Reference librarian after another who is intrigued by her story and pulls up different research. But, and the second librarian she meets with pulls up the Brooklyn Eagle, the newspaper in Brooklyn, and finds her parents' wedding. On the society page, the story of her parents' wedding. And she's never seen a picture of her mother. She doesn't know any of these people, her mother's family. Mm-hmm. And it's just like this huge gift to her, or Pandora's box, however. And so that leads her down the path of seeing some names. And then later she follows that trail. Mm-hmm. Back to Albuquerque. It's not immediate.
She's very resourceful.
You know, I want to ask a question. You had to do some research on this. You give Ruby a job, which probably, I guess, you really had at the School for the Blind.
Right.
And how did that transpire?
You know, there's so many things that are inspired by just like a word or something. And I wanted Ruby, something interested me about the symbolism of blindness and so forth. So but in my life story, my grandmother did work at a school for the blind in Philadelphia. So I took, but I don't know anything else about it. So I took her there. Mm-hmm. So, and then I just thought that so much of it worked. that symbolism of Braille and reading the Braille and so forth. And anyway, so that gives Ruby a life because she lives there.
How did she learn Braille and get to, well, how did she get to Puerto Rico and learn Braille there?
You know, I don't reveal that. So
that's between Martha and Ruby.
You all are such close readers. My brain's going, wait. So yes, she says at some point that that's where she learned to read Braille. And it was during the war that she was, her character was during the war. So I just took it and went with that. But the School for the Blind in Philadelphia is a real school. Mm-hmm. And so it was fun to do the research on that school.
Mm-hmm. You know, I come from Columbus, Ohio, and when I was a kid growing up in high school, there was a School for the Blind.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And I don't know any people. I'd ask, you know, I'm assuming, this is just an assumption on my part, that the mass of the population is not really familiar with these kind of schools. And I doubt that too many of us really have encountered people that are really blind. We see somebody on the street with a white cane and maybe a service dog.
Right.
But we never sit down and talk with them. And in high school, I was on a wrestling team, and we competed against the wrestling team for the blind.
There you go. Yeah,
it was just an interesting situation. Mm-hmm. We thought we had a big advantage when we were wrestling with these folks, and they thought they had a big advantage because we were feeling sorry for them, so they took advantage of that.
Well,
it's interesting.
I like the symbolism of that, and in the history of this school, what I had found was that some parents abandoned their children. So mm-hmm. I was, in the novel, I was playing with themes of abandonment. Mothers.
Mm-hmm. 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 We're going to take another very short break and hear from our sponsor, Out West Shop. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the cover and the title and some of the other artwork in the book. So stay tuned. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out outwestshop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer with special guest Martha Burns, Eddie Brooke, Across the Narrows. And we're going to talk about this cover, right?
Yes. First, let's just talk a little bit about the title, and then we're going to talk about this gorgeous artwork. So tell us, how did this title come to you?
Well, the title came to me because at the end of the novel, the Alice character with her daughter, they drive out of New Jersey over to Brooklyn, and by then to revisit Alice's childhood home and so forth. And she hadn't been there since she was a 5-year-old. But they drive in New Jersey, you drive over to Staten Island, and then you catch the Verrazano's Narrows Bridge and into Brooklyn. So that was an image that stuck with me, is that Verrazano's Narrows Bridge. And then, I don't know, somehow across the Narrows, because the Narrows is the strait that connects Upper New York Bay to Lower New York Bay. Upper New York Bay is also known as New York Harbor, and Lower New York Bay is where the Statue of Liberty is. Mm-hmm. But to get between the two, you have to pass through this strait called the Narrows. Mm-hmm. And it can be treacherous, and it the novel opens, or in the early part of the novel, there is a ship that they're on board and they pass through the Narrows. But then when we were talking the other night, when I was talking to Jim and Bobby the other night, you know, I think it's so much fun for a writer to have a reader call your attention to something that you didn't necessarily know you were doing. Yeah. And so I think it also speaks to this relationship between the mother and daughter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and as readers, I think we both are always trying to figure out how to tie, you know, the title to a book. And sometimes it'll show up in a sentence on the last page or, you know, yeah. or something. Mm-hmm. Right. And what I kept thinking about was that narrow passage that these two women are, you know, Alice really wants to connect, and they're trying to connect to history, trying to connect through a very narrow kind of, not pipeline, but a narrow way, especially without the internet and everything else out there. She's a very narrow way to try to connect. And and it is like voices across, you know, voices across the narrows. I just thought. Right. And today when we went online and we looked at pictures of the Verrazano's Bridge, because I couldn't really remember it. And I gasped. I mean, your description of it is fabulous in the book. I know I would not want to be on that bridge.
Yes.
But when I looked at pictures, like, oh my goodness. Driving the van, there's that scene where they drive the van across it towards the end, and it's like, oh my faith, you got to have a lot of faith to cross that bridge.
You go up for a while and then you come down, you crest. Yeah,
I know the first time I was on, I thought this bridge is it never going to end, you know.
Yes.
And I was not familiar with it. As you and I talked before and the other night, you said that it was kind of finished in 1964, I guess, you know,
right.
And I guess I forgot about, because I didn't hit that bridge till about 73. And I had forgotten all about that bridge. And I thought, what is this bridge? And it's like almost a mile long.
No, and there's no turn back.
Yeah. No.
Well, and it is a very apropos title. Now, I want to talk about the other part of the cover. I'm going to really try to hold this up to the camera. So there is a beautiful illustration on the cover. And also, I think by the same artist, we have at the beginning of each kind of part. Is this the brownstone that you mentioned?
That is the brownstone where Ruby grew up. Right.
Yeah, so okay. That's part one. And then part two, we have another lovely illustration.
And that's the school for the blind.
And that's the school for the blind. And then we have, I think, just one more for part three. And this is part three.
That is the Alice's childhood home before she left Brooklyn.
Okay. Right. So tell us how those illustrations all work together and this gorgeous one on the cover.
Well, I don't remember how I found this. I found this sketch artist in Brooklyn. Her name is Jen Toth, T-O-T-H. And I think I found her on Etsy, but now I can't remember. Anyway, so she's kind of a romantic, whimsical, a painter and so forth. She paints on an iPad. I had visions of her standing on a street corner with watercolors, but that's not true anymore. So I commissioned her. I really wanted illustrations in the interior of the book, and I commissioned her to do those three. But then when my publisher, they were starting to think about the cover, the graphic artist really felt like there should be consistency between the cover and those sketches. So I commissioned her to do the cover. And what that cover is those are the gates to Greenwood Cemetery where the book opens. Mm-hmm. And what's fun, I don't know whether if I hold this up, mm-hmm. you can see it, but in the hardcover, in the dust jacket on the...
Yes.
The publisher surprised me with this... with this concept rather than having a bunch of words again here. Yeah. And so they blew it up so that you could see the spire of those gates more closely. Yeah. And there's a bird's nest and it's
gates.
And so that, and in that is at the beginning of the novel, very important story.
Mm-hmm.
Greenwood Cemetery. One of the opening scenes is at Greenwood Cemetery, and it's a magnificent cemetery. Really, mm-hmm. go there.
We were on their website earlier today, and I just know I have to have a block of time and go back because there's just a wealth of information. And the image when you hit the website, I don't know if it's a drone or what, is taking, and it just took my breath away. And it's such a clear, you know, what's been caught here on the cover
right.
is just gorgeous. But go and look at Green-Wood Cemetery. Go take a look at their website. It's unbelievable, the information that's there.
After you read the book.
After you read the book. Because you want to know what happens. That cemetery, okay. It's another important place.
It is.
In this book.
It's interesting. You have different little stories within a story here. Talk to us about Meet Me at the Eagle.
Okay. And again, when we were talking just a few minutes ago before we went live, I had kind of forgotten about, even though I just reread the book. Meet Me at the Eagle is something that Ruby's parents, it was the pastor of this church who was, he was like poetic. Everything he said was poetic. And then his wife, Ella, they were a love story. And in their early years, before they moved to Brooklyn, they lived in Philadelphia. And they would go to Wanamaker's, a beautiful department store in Philadelphia. And he would let her shop, and he would maybe tour a little bit around the city. And then he would say, "Meet me at the Eagle." And so then they had six children. Ruby was the youngest of those six children. And that was something that she would hear her parents say to each other, you know, "Meet mm-hmm. me at the Eagle." Mm-hmm. And Ruby remembers that all of her life. Mm-hmm. It's just mm-hmm. one of those dear things that you hang on to.
Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. eagle was quite a bird.
2,500 pounds is an amazing sculpture. Oh, my goodness. You couldn't not know where to find
right.
it.
Right.
It wouldn't
right.
be like, which eagle are you talking about?
The bronze one.
Yes. Let's see. You also, this is all part of kind of that historical, that background we were talking about earlier. There's a wonderful scene of Alice in line to see Breakfast at Tiffany's when she's in New York, that same trip to New York. And the weather is kind of turned a little bit, and she's so used to all the sun in Albuquerque, she's kind of liking that we have a little bit of a different weather going on. But this is another moment where she wonders about a thought about her mom pops in her head, because there's a guy in line, and he's just a little, he reminds me of Peter Falk in that raincoat. He's just a little, you know, a little
dusty,
you know, and she's not sure. And he doesn't really come on to her or anything, but she's not comfortable. And she kind of says to herself, would my mom go shoo fly, you know, shoo away from me. And she does go into the movie. And then what does she want to do later on when her husband picks her up?
She wants to go back to Tiffany's.
Yeah.
She only stays in the movie a short time because it's not that she's being dishonest to her husband. She wants to see a little bit of Breakfast at Tiffany's and then go to the library.
In the library.
And she doesn't want to have to tell him or share. That's what her plan is. And she thinks she knows where the library is because she thinks if she gets in a cab and she can find her way to the library. But, and then later that evening after her husband is there, they're in New York to attend a conference that he attends every other year. And after they have dinner, she asks him if he'll take her to Tiffany's. Mm-hmm. And he says, "Well, it's closed." And she says, "I just want to stand in front of the window."
Yeah. It's just a charming, another piece of history, you know, another glimpse of history for that time period that I just really, really enjoyed. Let's see, Jim, what else? I'm looking at time. We are going to have to start to wrap, but you must have another question or two.
Yeah, you're working on a book launch, right?
I am. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and we have wonderful independent bookstores, and I hope you guys are able to come up. I am going to do a book launch on March 3rd. My book is not out yet. And when we scheduled this with you all, you know, it comes out next Tuesday.
Yes, it does.
There you go.
You can pre-order it everywhere right now, whether you're on our site or somebody else's, because it was a privilege. When we get to read something before it actually publishes, that's really quite amazing. For us, it feels like really an honor to have that opportunity. Yeah. let's see. What are you working on next?
I am working on something, and I've given myself a new challenge. It's also like, phew, because both of my novels were written in multiple points of view, but both of them span a period of time. And this novel I'm writing is, it's got a working title of Blue Scents, but it takes S-E-N-S-E. It takes place on Oahu, Hawaii in the summer of 1985. And I'm just confining myself, and it has its own challenges, you know, to have enough to tell. But it's the summer of 1985, and it's actually when someone, I seem to be doing this, repeating myself, when a young girl goes missing. And so it's built around that, around an actual, once again, an actual story.
Does it have a working title you can share, or does that need to stay quiet? That's right. You just
sense, but yes. And I lived in, and I love writing about place. I just love digging into place again. Yeah. My husband and I, we lived in Hawaii for quite a few years and raised our family there. Well, early years. So it's fun to go back. You know,
It would be. Yeah. It would be.
Mm-hmm. We had a question. We only have another moment before we'll really officially have to wrap up. But because some of your family is kind of inspiring parts of this book, how has your family responded to the story?
Well, my family is much smaller than it used to be, and I wish my mother could read this novel because I wish she could.
Yeah.
And all of the characters are gone, you know. My mom's, you know, original family, her sisters and so forth, they're all gone. I have cousins. I have a cousin in New Zealand who did a lot of research on, you know, on my mom and loved my mother and so forth. And I mailed her the book and she got it the other day. And she said, The trouble with writing about family too is that everybody has their own,
And,
I have two sisters, and I think that they are very generous to let me tell the story.
And Jim has a couple quotes.
Okay, read these quotes.
Yes. Here we go.
We got three tonight.
We do. I think we have time.
Oh, yeah, I got this one from, this is Ruby's mom, Ella. And she's giving her a little advice. It won't do to show anyone the complexity of what you are thinking. Withholding your thoughts makes your thoughts more interesting. No man needs the whole story. And then from Ruby's friend, Kate. And she says, now listen to me. Your children will not forgive you for any of this mess. Not until they know what happened, but maybe not even then. Who knows about forgiveness? So why don't we forgive our mothers right now? I thought that was pretty good.
And one more.
And our final quote. This is from the New York Times in 1866. And it's found on the homepage, also the Greenwood website. It's the ambition of the New Yorker to live upon Fifth Avenue, to take his errands in the Central Park, and to sleep with his fathers in Greenwood.
Well, we thank you, Martha, for being with us tonight. We've been talking with award-winning author Martha Burns about her book, Across the Narrows. Next week, we have award-winning singer, songwriter, author, a man with so many talents, Jim Jones, will be joining us. His most recent book is Halo Moon, but he's just released a brand new album called a storyteller, Songs from the West. And so we will be talking to Jim and hearing some of his music from his Words and Music CD and his newest one. And it'll all be about the similarities between songwriting and writing and storytelling. So join us next week. We thank everybody for being with us tonight.
Very quickly, how can we find you?
Oh, yes. How can we find you?
I have a website. It's MarthaBurnsWriter.com. So
very good.
And every now and then I hear from somebody I knew from long ago. So that's nice.
That's cool. Nice. Well,
okay. And from us, it's always a great day out west.
We'll see you down the trail. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Martha.
Thank you.